When you need expert help and advice on issues affecting your business, NFU Cymru, we're here for you.
Farmers Guardian is proud to work alongside the Rock and Roll Farming Podcast. For all the latest news and features from across the ag industry, head to fginsight.com. You'll also find a wide variety of advice pieces to help you and your farming business flourish.
Want to get to know the people who produce the food that you eat? This is the place. Step this way and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming. Hey everybody, and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming episode 121. I'm your host Will Evans, and tonight I'm very excited to be heading up to Cumbria to talk to hill farmer and author Andrea Meanwell. Andrea, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. It's a glorious evening here in Cumbria, looking out across the field, so I'm really well, thank you, Will.
Good, and did you have a good day yesterday, because you hosted an Open Farm Sunday event at your place?
That's right, we did, yeah. We had a good day. I think the walk was scheduled to last for about 90 minutes and we ended up talking for about 3 hours because people are so interested in farming and so many questions. Yeah, we had a really good day.
Fantastic. Is that the first time you've done it?
No, I first did it when I bought my small farm in the Lake District. We bought that in 2009. And I had actually been to an event at Overbury Farm. I think the account on Twitter is Number One Farm Jake.
Jake, that's right, Jake Freestone.
Yeah, and I'd been to one of his Lambing Live events, and I thought, when I get my farm, I'm going to do this myself because this is a brilliant event.
Yeah.
So the first year that we moved to the Lake District, we did a small Open Farm Sunday. I think we did two consecutive years, and then we didn't do it for a while. And then we did it last year when we moved here, and this is the second one that we've done here.
Fair. So why do you decide to participate in that? Why do you think it's such a good thing?
I think it's just really important that we share the good things that we're doing, the good work that we're doing. And I'm really keen to share all of the environmental initiatives that we've got here on the farm, and basically just to show people that hill farmers are not sheep wrecking the landscape. Because we get a lot of bad press at the moment. I'm not really sure why, but the uplands do seem to come in from a lot of stick from environmental journalists, and I just want to put our side of the story across, really.
Yeah.
And show all of the important work that we're doing here.
Yeah, so when you have visitors on the farm, like yesterday, what kind of response did you get?
I've always got a really positive response, and I guess that's the people who are turning up to the event are interested and respond positively. But I have to say, the day before that, I was at an agricultural show and I was talking to the sheep farmers before lunch, and that went really well. But after lunch, I was there in my new role representing the Lake District National Park, and I did have people coming up to me then saying that farming shouldn't be allowed in the national park and that it should be all rewilded. And obviously giving their opinion that that the Lake District should be a lot wilder than it is.
That narrative has really grown over the last few years, hasn't it? It's just a case of putting your side of the story across, I suppose.
Yeah, and it is tricky because people perceive if the landscape was left to do its own thing, that it would be a better place for wildlife. And so it's up to us farmers, I think, to shout out all the wildlife that we do have on farms. And to talk about how a lot of the habitats that animals need are actually created by grazing animals. Because some of the criticism I was getting at the weekend was about ground nesting birds and how it would be much better for them if the environment was totally wild. Well, actually, it wouldn't be, because they need a grazed area in which to nest. But a lot of people, for some reason, seem to have the perception that farming is just bad for the environment.
Yeah, okay. So we'll come back onto that later, but for now, tell us a bit about where you live for people listening who might not be from the UK, because it's a pretty special part of the country, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I'm actually in, well, the land that we own, the farm that we own, is in the Yorkshire Dales National Park, And I'm right on the boundary where the Yorkshire Dales meets the Lake District. And then our rented land is in the Lake District National Park. We're actually farming in two national parks at the moment. it's an upland area. It's very green. It's sort of rolling hills, very old-fashioned, traditional kind of farming with the common system. And the native breeds of sheep here are the rough fell sheep.
Wow, okay. And your family go way back there, right?
Yeah, I can definitely trace them back about 500 years.
Wow.
My family were described in the census as yeoman farmers, so that means that they owned their own land. Over time, I'm not sure what's happened, but by the time we get to my granddad's parents, they were both hired hands on farms. That's how they met. They went and stood in the market square in Kirby Stephen when they were 14, when they finished school, and then they were hired by a farmer.
Wow.
So my granddad was hired as a livestock hand, and my grandma was hired as a dairymaid.
Wow.
And that's how they met. And then my granddad wanted to do the same when he left school. He wanted to become a hired hand, and they wouldn't let him because they'd both been so badly treated on farms. They'd managed to get their own rented house, and they were really proud of that. And they said, there's no way you're going to be hired. So he wasn't able to be a farmer.
Okay. I mean, your love of farming initially came from helping out on your uncle's place when you were a child, right?
That's right. He had a small hill farm in the North Pennines near Kirby Stephen. And he was he's a really respected breeder of Swaledale sheep. He breeds Tups itself for thousands. And so it was a brilliant person to learn from. And at the time, this was in the 1970s, he was doing a lot of experiments with crossing sheep. So he was crossing the blue-faced Leicester onto the Swaledale. And he actually went on to become founding member of NEMSA, the North of England Mule Sheep Association. So that was really important work that he was doing with those sheep when I was little.
Yeah, so he's a really good person to be learning from then.
Oh yeah, he really knows about sheep, so that was great for me to be able to see that as a child.
Yeah, okay, but you ended up studying archaeology at university. That must have been interesting.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, I was doing quite well at school, and it was suggested that I went to university. Nobody from my family at all ever had been to higher education before. And they were saying, well, do a proper academic subject, go to a top university. And so I was looking for something that was practical. The only two courses I could find were landscape architecture. Well, who needs a landscape architect in an environment like this? I didn't have the right subjects for that. And the other one was archaeology. And I've always been interested in history. So I went and I did a degree in archaeology and ancient history in Manchester.
Wow. It must have been really, really interesting. I know you obviously haven't ended up in a career in it, but it must have been a brilliant subject to study.
It was quite interesting. But to be honest, it wasn't that practical because we spent a lot of time looking at other people's holiday slides. Digs I have done in the 1950s. So it wasn't that interesting. My first year after I graduated, I got a job guarding the Midland Jewel in the Yorkshire Museum. That was a jewel that somebody had found a metal detecting, and the museum had bought it for £2.5 million. And a condition of showing it to the public was that somebody had to guard it 24 hours a day, or at least when the museum was open. So I was employed as the guard, and it had this very elaborate system of lasers that were guarding it with alarms. And so during the winter, when there was very few visitors to the museum during the winter, I would be like crawling along the floor trying to get as near to this jewel as I could without tripping. It was a bit like Wallace and Gromit, if you've seen the Robin Hood. But I didn't have techno trousers. I was just moving around the gallery trying to amuse myself by getting as near to this jewel as I could without setting the alarms off.
So all I can think of when you tell that story is Tom Cruise in Mission Impossible. I can just imagine you sort of hanging from a rope from the ceiling.
Yeah, but less glamorous than Tom Cruise.
We're going to take a short ad break now to talk about agricultural weighing specialist Griffith Elder. Griffith Elder specialise in agriculture with their weighing equipment. They design, manufacture here in the UK and supply weighbridges, portable weigh beams, multi-axle weigh bridges and a host of other weighing equipment for weighing on the farm. The scales are a great way to know how much you've taken from the field and keep track what you have coming in and going out. The portable weigh beams are incredibly easy to install, so no need for any groundworks, and can be placed straight in the yard or moved from store to store as and when you need. All of their scales come with an extensive range of recording equipment options and farm management software, and one very popular piece of kit is their cab fob system, which enables the driver to record the weight of their load without having to leave the comfort of the cab. Built to last for decades, Griffith Elder pride themselves in making simple to install, easy to operate and proven longevity weighing equipment for all their products. They'll be displaying a set of portable weigh beams for demonstration at the upcoming Cereals event in June. And if you're planning on going, head down to stand 966 for a chat to one of their specialists. Okay, so you ended up though in a career in teaching. Did you enjoy that?
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. I came back to Cumbria and worked in small schools in Cumbria, and it wasn't work to me. You know, absolutely loved it. We had 50 children in the school, and if it was a warm day, we'd go outside and we'd climb up the fell, and we'd sit on the fell and we'd draw the village beneath us. And, you know, I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, okay. Do you think, though, all that time that farming and the sort of pull back to the land was always there, though, in the back of your mind?
It was, definitely. The children that I was teaching were farming children. In fact, the first day when I arrived at the school, I asked one of them where he lived. And he said, well, are you going on a quad, or are you walking, or are you going in a car? You know, so, and then he drew me a map of how you would get to his farm by foot or on quad or in a Land Rover. And I thought, oh, I'm going to get on really well with this. and my husband and I, we didn't have a lot of money, and we only had one car between us. So I had to walk to school, and I had to walk over, it's called Hampsfell, a fell from Grange over Sands to Cartmel. And every day I'd see the same sheep in the same position, because that's where they were hefted. And I'd be doing like a little shepherding route, checking all sheep on the way to school. And I had my desk positioned so I could see out onto the fell, and I'd be watching the sheep. And it was always like an aspiration of mine that one day I'm going to have my own flock of sheep.
Yeah. So how did you ultimately get there? What were your first steps back into farming?
Well, we, over time, we kept moving and renovating houses and selling them on, with the aim that we'd be able to buy ourselves a small place in the country, because in the Lake District it costs an absolute fortune to get a kind of a small holding or a small farm. And you know, I didn't know if that would ever become achievable, but thankfully for us, property prices were going up and up, and we were able to make money. And then in 2009, we were able to buy a small holding in the Rutland Valley. And I started off with 2.5 acres, and I got two sheep given by a local farmer, two orphan lambs that started me off. And I actually asked him if I could go and help him for 2 days a week, because I said, you know, I'd like to brush up on my knowledge of sheep, and I'd like to learn about cows. So could I come and work with you and your cows for 2 days a week? I must have been, I was like nearly 40 at that point. I must have been the oldest apprentice ever in the Rutland Valley, I think. But it was good for him as well, because we had such a good crack. We really enjoyed ourselves, and I got on so well with him. And I think in the end, I probably was more of a help than a hindrance. Not at the start. He used to call me the cow whisperer. Because I used to call the cows and they used to come. But no, we had a great time, and I really enjoyed learning alongside him.
Yeah, and did you immediately think, yes, I'm home, this is what I'm supposed to be doing?
Yeah, I just loved it. And we had, it was very traditional cow barns that he had, where the cows are underneath the hay barn. And I would just stand, you know, resting on my fork, looking out across the valley and bringing my silage in and thinking, oh, this is just, you know, this is just fantastic. What a great life to be part of this.
How did you go about building up your acreage and your own sheep flock?
Well, we managed to rent some land from local people, and one of my sons was becoming particularly interested in farming, and so my husband decided that he would put his pension into a private pension scheme and buy farmland with that, that we could then lease off him to give us more of a start. So we managed to get, it was around, I think it was around 35 acres that we bought with the pension fund. And then we had that and about 35 acres of rented land as well, plus fell. So that gave us a chance to build up a flock of rough fell sheep, which was what we wanted to do.
Yeah. And I suppose your son showing an interest and going to agricultural college, I guess that was an added motivation to keep trying to get a farm of your own.
Yeah, it was definitely. And we tried to get tenancies on various farms. I tried with the National Trust. I was doing a bit of part-time work for the Wildlife Trust on their Hay Meadows project. And so I thought I would be quite well placed to get a tenancy because I was farming in a nature-friendly farming way. But we didn't manage to get that. We then decided to broaden the net to, the whole of the UK, really, and look at what was available. And we went for a Ministry of Defence tenancy, which was over in Northumberland. We put a lot of time and effort into that application, and then we didn't get that, so that was quite disappointing. So then we decided that we would sort of look at, if we sold our house, if we sold our land, how much money would we have and where could we get somewhere that would fit the needs that my son and I had. Obviously, that's quite tricky because you've got to sell separate bits of land at auction. You've got to sell a house, and you've got to find something affordable, and that took us, you know, a couple of years to sort out.
Yeah. It's not an easy thing to do, is it? To move lock, stock, and barrel like that.
No, it isn't. No, especially when you've established with schools and friendship groups and all that kind of thing.
Exactly.
But we have done it, and we are here, so that's great.
Yeah, so tell us about the place you're in now.
Well, as I said, it's in the Yorkshire Dale National Park. It has been two farms years and years ago. So there's basically two farms surrounded by meadows and allotment land linking the two. One of the farm yards and houses is totally derelict. That's because the motorway was put through the Loon Gorge and that cut off their access.
Okay.
So the people who were in that farm were paid to move out. So that's a redundant farm. And then we have our own farmstead, and that is actually built around the Roman Fort, which is in the valley.
Yes. And you know how excited I've been about that because I'm a massive history nerd, as you know. So yeah, I don't want to sort of take over the whole interview geeking out about this, but yeah, tell us about the Roman Fort. How much do you know about it?
Well, not that much, but the people who were selling the farm were really relieved that they could sell it to somebody who actually knew a little bit about Roman Britain. Because, of course, I'd studied Roman Britain at university.
Of course,
and then in those many hours spent in the galleries, when I wasn't dodging laser beams, I actually set about looking at all of the exhibits and reading all of the boards about Roman Britain. So I became a bit of a walking encyclopedia of knowledge about Roman Britain. And then when we turned up to look round the farm, and I was interested in not only the farm itself, but the archaeology, I think, that put us in a really good position to buy the farm.
Yeah.
Because the previous owners had been really interested in the fort.
Wow.
So it's in a strategic area, England and Scotland, and the border has been virtually here. Years ago, and it's been a much disputed area, and you can see miles to the south and you can see miles to the north, and that's why it's positioned here. And it was for the Roman soldiers to control this movement of people between England and Scotland, and it was actually occupied for over 400 years, so that's quite a long time.
Yeah.
And around the fort itself, there's actually the remains of the bathhouse and the manzio, which is like a posh Roman house that has mosaic floors. That's underneath our vegetable garden.
Is it? And wow, then, that's so cool.
And then down in our meadows, we have a parade ground where they would have practiced. And then at the bottom of the parade ground, we have a native British cemetery. And then on top of that, we have the Roman cemetery where wow. all of the Roman bodies are buried.
Wow.
So it's quite an extensive area. It's like, I think it's 31 acres of scheduled ancient monuments
yeah.
around the house. And, of course, the house itself is largely built from Roman stone because it's been plundered from the fort.
So, yeah.
For example, we have some traditional pigsties where my two little pigs live, and they've got a Roman altar built in their doorway.
Wow.
So everywhere you look, there's history around here.
Yeah. So how much responsibility do you have for it? Do you have to maintain it or do anything to it, or have you got to just leave it alone?
Well, basically, we've just got to leave it alone. But yeah. if ever we want to do anything, like at the moment, we're having to put a new septic tank in because of the new building regulations. So we have to get scheduled ancient monument consent for that. And then, thankfully, because I am an archaeologist, I can supervise the work.
Yeah.
So I've had to write a whole scheme of how I'm going to do that. And then when the works take place, when they're actually replacing the septic tank, I have to be there on the lookout for finds and things.
Well,
you never know, we might find something.
That's so cool. Is it nice to sort of, if you tie back into the archaeology world after so long?
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's really yeah. interesting. I've always found it fascinating.
Yeah.
And not only the Roman site as well, because the house itself, there's a farmhouse which we think dates from the 15th century, and then built onto that is a coaching inn. With all the original coat hooks up really high for people to put their long riding mats on and rings outside for them to tie up their horses to. And then built onto that is also a courthouse where they used to have disputes to do with grazing and things like that. So that was a local courtroom. We've also got that.
Wow.
And then out the back of the house, we've got a navvy's tap room, where when they were building the railway through in 1846, they didn't want all of the navvies coming to the posh coaching house, so they built them a bar on the back. and we've got that as well. So the whole place is just really interesting.
Wow. Wow, that's incredible. So have you ever seen or felt any ghosts, legionaries, kicking around while you've been there?
My son thinks he has.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
That's really cool. Well, the reason I haven't interviewed you sooner, as you know, because I asked you if you'd be interviewed right at the start of this podcast, and it's because I've been hoping to come up there and do it in person, and now,
yeah.
and it just hasn't really worked out, but now I'm even more determined than ever to call in and see you and the Forks.
You will have to, yeah.
That's so cool.
It's really interesting.
Yeah. Okay, so one thing I did want to ask you about is, along the way back into farming, you said you nearly got killed by a cow. How did that happen?
Well, we had our first little herd were Dexters, and we had to TB test them really regularly because of a breakdown that
yeah.
somebody else had had to a link holding. And so one evening we were getting the cows in for a TB test. My son Hector had just actually done his last ever GCSE, so we'd left school and we were in quite a buoyant mood. And we'd driven home from his school over the fell in the Land Rover. You know, we were really in a good mood, and we thought, oh, we'll just check the cows. And one of them had calved. And I had in my mind that the vet had said to me, I'm coming to do the TB testing now, not the tag police, but just to make sure that they are all tagged. So I had in my mind that they had to be tagged. And I said to Hector, oh, we'll just tag this calf now while we're here. So we went back to get the pliers and everything, and we were just in the middle of the field. And I started to tag the calf, and it let out just a tiny little murmur. Mm. And its mother, who was a first-time calver, a heifer, mm-hmm. obviously didn't like that and just totally lost it. And very quickly got me on the floor. I was between a wall and a crag, so I was like trapped in this little area with the cow jumping on me, and the cow was going jump, 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 and then jumping off and going jump, jump, jump. And I was lying face down on a rock that had fallen off a wall, and it was just pressing my head into that rock. And I was aware that there was like blood seeping out everywhere. And Hector, who had moved back when the cow started attacking me, said to me, you know, I thought there was no way you were surviving that, Mum.
Yeah.
But somehow he was watching the cow and she was going jump, jump, jump and jumping off and having a pause. And somehow it was like the adrenaline that you build up in a situation like that. He then ran in, lifted me up and literally threw me over this dry stone wall. I mean, how he did that, I don't know. Ordinarily, you wouldn't be able to do that in an ordinary circumstance, but he did that and then he ran off to get help. And it was a bit of a catalogue of disaster because Oscar, my oldest son, had just passed his driving test and he was outside sitting in the car, kind of getting used to it and with the radio on, and he'd flattened the battery on the car. So when Hector came belting down the hill, shouting, quick, emergency, he couldn't get the car started. Somehow I was like drifting in and out of consciousness, lying there with this pool of blood coming out of my head. And I've said to Hector, don't ring 999. Because of where we are, they'll send the air ambulance and that costs thousands. I said, and I don't want thousands of pounds being spent on me with this accident. So don't ring 999. So poor Hector was like running around trying to find somebody to help. The car wouldn't start. So they ran up to some neighbours and she was just cooking a roast dinner. So she stopped cooking the roast dinner and came out in a brand new Volvo with a white leather interior.
Oh, no.
And that morning she'd been on a speed awareness course. So we had this journey to hospital where she'd brought some tea towels and my head wrapped in tea towels, but there was literally blood spurting all over the interior of this white Volvo. And she was saying to my two sons in the back, do you know what the speed limit is here? Better not go too fast, because she'd been on a speed awareness course. So we travelled to hospital with blood going all over this lovely white car at about 20 miles an hour. So it was quite a story in itself.
That's incredible. I mean, I suppose... when you go through something like that traumatic accident, it's the little things that you remember, isn't it? Like that, very clear.
That's right. Yeah.
My mother had a similar thing about 15 years ago. A cow attacked my mother actually, and our herdsman heard the commotion. He ran to help, and he ended up being put in hospital as well. They were both. It can happen really, really easily, can't it?
I mean, Hector had actually said to me, as soon as the calf made a little noise, he'd said to me, just leave it.
Mm.
He was a lot more aware of the cow's mood than I was. I was like focused on, we've got the vet coming, we've got to do this, you know, and so that was a real lesson to me.
Yeah.
That in future, I've got to be a lot more aware of what the animal wants and not just what I want to do, and also have them properly contained in a, you know, in a safe area before I start doing anything like that.
Okay, well, fortunately you recovered and eventually you wrote a book. How did you start with the writing?
Well, I had always done a bit of writing. I'd written for university newspapers and whatever. It was always a bit of a family joke that one day I was going to write a book, and my husband was always saying, you know, well, come on, where's this book. But the thing that set me off with the writing was I got so enraged with the articles in The Guardian, particularly by George Monbiot, about the area being sheep wrecked, with no mention of the cultural heritage of the area and how getting rid of sheep would just basically wipe out our culture here. Because all of our interests and our hobbies, you know, as a family, showing sheep, going to shows, it's all based around the culture of shepherding. That is what the cultural heritage of this area is. And I was getting really cross with people writing about what should be done in our landscape, you know, on the land that we own, and just disregarding the actual people who live here. So I thought, I want to put my side across. So first of all, I wrote an article for The Guardian, and that was really well received. It was the most commented on article in The Guardian that week, even though the budget came out that week and things, it seemed to be my article about shepherding that was getting all of the comments. Obviously not all comments for my point of view, for and against, but it showed that there was a real interest in shepherding and in hill farming. So going on from that, the first book that I wrote was a book of poems, which I sent to my publisher. And she said, it's great, but there's no market for a book of poetry. So can you write a prose book? So I sat and wrote a book about just my history in farming and what it meant to me and what it meant to my family. And that was the first book that came out. And thankfully, people enjoyed it. And I've then gone on to write two more books since then that have been published, and there's a new book coming out at the end of this year about buying this farm here. Wow. And moving to this farm and the first year here.
Yeah.
And the reason for writing about farming and just sharing it is just to show how important upland farms are to this area and how important they are to our cultural heritage, and just to share with people what it's actually like to live on a farm here.
Yeah, well, I've read A Native Breed, your first book, as you know, and it's really obvious. I mean, I sort of read quite a lot of these kind of books about the countryside and that sort of stuff, and it's really obvious how in tune with where you live and the dramatic landscape and the way of life is. Do you hear that a lot? Do people say that kind of thing a lot to you?
And when I read the reviews online, people have said that they feel that they're actually there in the place.
Yeah.
Because what I'm just trying to do is, I'm not doing it as an academic exercise. I'm not trying to, you know, write it in a really scholarly or academic way. I'm just trying to write about what it's actually like. So, for instance, in my new book, when we've had an incidence of sheep worrying, I've then gone back and I've written about how I actually feel at that point.
Yeah.
You know, when some of my sheep have been killed, the effect that that has on me. I think after that, I go out and I scrub a load of cobbles for about 3 hours because I've just got to do something and I've got to put some energy into something other than thinking about, you know, my sheep that have been killed. So what I'm trying to share with people is just, you know, the real emotion involved in yeah, farming in an area like this.
Yeah, I was going to say, because it's quite obvious that you write from the heart. You really feel it. So do you enjoy the whole process of writing? I mean, it must have been incredible when you first got your book sent back from the publishers.
Oh, yeah, I really enjoy it. Yeah, it's kind of low-key in my family, you know. Most of my family haven't read what I've written. So it's not like it's a big massive thing, but I really value the fact that people buy the books and the comments.
Yeah.
That, you know, the feedback that I get. So that's why I keep writing. Generally, I write from 10 o'clock at night to midnight.
Mm-hmm.
On my own in a little room, just writing about what's happening at the time.
Yeah.
And just, it's kind of a period of reflection as well, I guess, about what's going on the farm.
Yeah, I laughed when you said that your family haven't read your books. That's a real typical farming family thing, isn't it? I can imagine my family doing that if I ever write a book. Yeah, okay.
Well, my husband's read the third book, and he's not a quick reader, and he sat there for about 3 days in front of the Raeburn stove reading it, and I was like watching him reading it, looking for some sort of reaction. And then I said at the end, "Well, what did you think? How was it?" And he said, "As expected." I said, "Well, what do you mean?" He said, "Well, it was as I expected it to be." And so that's the feedback that I got, as expected. Whether that's good or not, I don't know.
That's brilliant. So you mentioned the environmentalists and the attacks on upland farmers, and that's what sort of inspired you to tell the story of hill farming in that area. Do you think that that people are listening to us when we do things like your book and what I'm trying to do with this podcast? And there's lots of people out there in farming who are trying to put our side of the story across. Do you think we're making progress with it?
I really really hope we're making progress with it, yeah. And I think it's important. And what we've really got to do is, because there's a lot of discussion now about public money for public goods, mm-hmm. we've really got to just show the good work that we're doing, because it's very easy for somebody to highlight the bad things. You know, good things often don't make interesting news, do they? Mm-hmm. But we've just got to keep on positively sharing everything that we're doing, and I do believe that we're making progress.
Now, as of this week, I believe you have an exciting new job to tell us about.
I do have an exciting new job. I am the farming officer for the Lake District National Park.
That's really cool. So how did that come about?
We saw the job advertised. What had happened last year was that I farm in partnership with my middle son Hector, and he was working off farm on up to three different farms. And then, so we'd have 5 days off the farm, and then we'd have 2 days together on the farm doing big jobs like gathering and things. Mm-hmm. And I'd be on the farm full time. But obviously, he's wanting to come back and work more on our farm. Because there's a lot of things, to be honest, that a 20-something-year-old male can do that a 50-year-old woman isn't practical at, like fencing and walling and all those kinds of jobs. So he was wanting to spend more time on the farm. And then I saw the job advertised, and I just thought it was something that was a really important role. So I had a chat with him, and he said, well, just go for it. And if you get the job, then we'll swap round and you can work off farm and I'll come home and work on the farm. And that's, we're just starting that now. So he's left his other job and come back to work here on the farm. And I'm working in this farming officer role. And then I'll be here some days on the farm with him together.
Cool. It sounds like such a cool job title, farming officer. What does what does that actually entail? What will you be doing?
Well, listening to farmers and finding out what their concerns are, and then hopefully thinking of ways forward that we can help farmers through the National Park Authority. So I'm thinking of ideas of like sharing good practice, so setting up workshops for people to come and look at good practice on other farms, such as somebody who does a really good diversification, somebody who's working with the Herdwick Lamb PDO, somebody who's a new tenant who can share the whole process of getting a tenancy. Just different people who are involved in farming who want to share their practice with other farmers. And then we'll identify themes that we want to help people with going forward. So that's part of it. That's one part of the role. Another part is to share good practice in the Lake District. So to positively promote the good work that the farmers are doing through social media and through writing and various other means, just to show people you know, the good that we're doing, the value that there is in upland farming, particularly with this discussion, as we've said, about public money for public goods. You know, mm-hmm. we've really got to demonstrate the public good that we're doing. And I think we can do a lot of that through image sharing and through social media. So that's part of the job.
Yeah.
Another part is to administer we're trialling a historic buildings grant scheme here in the Yorkshire Dales and in the Lake District. And part of it is helping with that. And there's a few trial cases going through now where traditional farm buildings are being renovated. And the farmer is getting 80% of the cost back through the grant scheme. So I'll have input into that to hopefully make that run efficiently. So hopefully that will be something that will be available to a wider audience in the future.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's really encouraging that the National Park Authority there want to have someone in that role, isn't it? That they recognise the importance of hill farmers to the communities there.
Oh, it's really encouraging. And also, I think it's encouraging that they've chosen an actual farmer to do it.
Absolutely, yeah.
Somebody who has seen what, you know, knows what it's like to actually do the job of farming. And also, I mean, I've only just started the job, but they keep saying that they want me to have input into defining the role. So they're not saying, you must do this, you must do that. Mm. You know, we're, first of all, we're looking at what we think the role should be to benefit farmers, and then that will be our way forward, which is great.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, I guess as part of it, you'll be dealing with farmers, but also some pretty high-profile people too.
Well, yeah, I'll be dealing with a lot of the partner organisations as well, like the Wildlife Trust,
yeah.
Who I've worked with before. So I think, you know, it's important that I've got to be able to communicate not only with the farmers, but with other organisations. So so that's great. And looking at the trialling the ELM scheme, that if we leave Europe, then, you know, having some input into the new land management scheme.
Yeah, if we leave Europe, that's the question on everyone's lips, isn't it? Yeah, okay.
Yes, it is, yeah.
Yeah, so you mentioned that your son will be taking on your role at the farm. You must have been, it must have been fantastic to see his confidence grow with the farm over the years.
Yeah, it is, and it's a curious mixture of, like, pride and imminent redundancy on my part. I'm sure you'll probably feel it as well, Will, one day when somebody takes over doing a job from you.
Yeah.
It's a funny thing. Like, last year at the Rough Fell auction, when the sheep that we're wanting to buy started coming into the ring, we were both sat down and he stood up and I stood up next to him. He said, "No, Mum, you sit down. You know, I'm doing this." And I sat there watching him, and it was a funny mix of emotions. You know, I was really proud that I had a son that had an interest and was up there making the decisions. But at the same time, it's like, oh, you know, my time for decision making is coming to an end, obviously, because I'm being told to sit down.
No, that's fantastic. So what does the future hold for you, Andrew?
Well, I'll be working on this job for 2 years with the Lake District National Park, and then Petra and I will just be building up the farm, and we've got a lot of work to do for habitats, and we've got about 3.5 miles of riverbank of the River Loon that we're going to fence off for a riparian strip for wildlife habitats, and we've got a lot of infrastructure to rebuild in terms of tumble down dry stone walls and things like that. So just sitting here now looking out across the farm as I am, there's a lifetime's work there, you know. I don't need to be short of anything to do.
Yeah,
I can also see some escaping sheep that are where they shouldn't be as well. So that's the next job.
Yeah, well, you've got plenty of fencing to keep you going with by the sounds of it anyway.
Yeah.
Okay, so I better let you go and catch these sheep then, so we better finish it with the 5 quick questions, if you're ready. Yeah. So what is your all-time favourite song?
Waterfall by the Stone Roses.
Oh, that is such a good choice.
Brilliant. The reason that I like that song is because she carries on through it all. She's a waterfall.
Yeah.
And when I'm having a bad day on the farm and it's pouring with rain and I'm out on the quad and I just sing that to myself, that I've got to carry on and be like a waterfall and just keep on going.
Brilliant. Killer intro as well. Fantastic. What's your idea of a perfect Sunday?
Well, often on a Sunday morning, we gather the sheep because that's when Hector and I are together. So the perfect Sunday morning would be when we're up early and it's wonderful weather and all of the sheep gather very easily and go into the pens with no problems, no shouting, no swearing on his part. and then in the afternoon, my husband is the captain of Borrowdale Fell Runners and he likes to go to fell races. So it would be going to watch him from a mountaintop running the fell race.
That's cool. That sounds great. Okay, what's your, you are obviously well read as an author. What's your Desert Island Discs book? What book would you take to a desert island if you were stranded there?
Well, I'd like a whole set of Herdwick Flock books and A Map of the Lake District, if that's all right, Will. So that's over 100 years of recorded Herdwick Flocks, and I think that would keep me very interested, looking at the size of the flocks and the whole history of shepherding in the Lake District.
That sounds fantastic. It's because Desert Island Discs is my fantasy job. I'm hoping I can do that and be a farmer at some point. So, yes, I will allow it.
Thank you.
So if you were elected Prime Minister, what would be the first thing you'd do?
Well, obviously I'd support traditional sustainable farms, particularly those with hefted flocks, because I just think hefted flocks of sheep are so important.
Yeah.
Beatrix Potter did a lot of work to keep those in the Lake District, so I'd make sure that they were kept, and I would ban dogs off lead around livestock, because that's caused me a lot of trouble in the past, and I have written on several occasions and been told that the minister is not minded to change the rules. But if I was the Prime Minister, I'd be minded to change the rules. And I would also have a look at whether there should be a carbon tax on air travel, because I'm sick of being told that farming is really bad for the environment because of emissions when people are flying around to meetings in private jets. So I would look at whether there should be a carbon tax on air travel.
I think you've just secured the farming vote anyway. You could be Prime Minister the way it's going. Everyone else is having a go.
Oh, no, thanks.
All right, then. And lastly, what is your favourite agricultural-related social media account to follow?
I love to follow Joyce at Armadale Farm because she just has fantastic sheep, and no other reason required than that. Joyce at Armadale Farm with a tibiot sheep.
Fantastic. All right, Andrea, it's been fantastic. As I mentioned, I've wanted to interview you since I started the podcast, so it's great to finally get the chance to speak to you. And next time we're heading up the M6 to Scotland, we'll try and call in.
Definitely. You do that, Will, and I've really enjoyed it. Thank you.
No, and best of luck with a new job. I hope it goes really well for you.
Thank you.
Speak to you soon. And to everyone at home, thanks for listening, and I hope to see you next time. I've been Will Owens, this has been Rock and Roll Farming. Thank you and good night.